alive.
You're supposed to use to get these to work. I mean, what people don't understand, Roberta, is that while you and I are talking, I am doing a significant amount of engineering while Michael G. Haskins on the other side is doing engineering down on Wall Street, and the two of us are linking up together. So all of this is taking place.
That was a memory gap,
Well, it sure was.
Of the machine as well as of the
air.
Of the air. Right.
Well, you see, but it's important because today we're talking about memory.
Yep.
You know, memory, and it's hard to really understand memory because memory is hard to understand. I've been working with it personally since I was 22 years old. I started working with Sam Berendes and Hirsch Cohen at Albert Einstein College of Medicine when we were trying to discover the actual cause of memory. What makes you memory? At the time, they had a few different theories. One was electrical, another was chemical. And there were other theories, and our basis was to prove the chemical basis, which is the one that won out. In other words, saying that memory is caused by a secretion of a number of things in the brain, and it's the chemical solution that results in memory storage. There were a lot of theories before then. Memory is learning that sticks.
Well said.
Before memory, potential new learnings linger briefly in a kind of a scratch pad. Before we remember things, experiences kind of sit in this small little spot in the prefrontal cortex. And then according to what we do with it, we're either going to remember it or not remember it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the brain has to decide at any given moment of the day or the night, because we can even memorize things while we sleep, what's important to remember and what can be let go of is not relevant to our survival. So first function of memory is survival, remembering what counts.
Now, you would wonder, well, why do we have to figure out what to remember and what not to remember? Just think about your computer. What do you trash and what don't you trash? And why do you trash anything and why do you empty the trash?
Oh, good point.
Because it is just so much storage.
And there are some things that you constantly have to be selective and have to prioritize. What's important and what I don't, and what is it that I don't need to keep? Because we only have so much space. And the same thing is in the brain, although the brain is that much larger and more flexible than a computer. But still, we have to be selective.
Roberta and I are going to be doing a series on memory because of the recent research that I've been doing with Posit Science on improving memory. I've been working the program myself. I got to tell a memory joke.
Oh, please do, Armand.
I have my favorite memory
joke.
You have
good jokes. I know your jokes are great.
A man goes to, I may have told this before, a man goes to his friend and he says to his friend, I've just got this new memory course. It's a fantastic memory course. It's a great memory course. And the friend says, what's the name of the memory course? He says, the name of the memory course. He says, what's the name of that flower that you give at Valentine's Day? It's red and it has thorns. And the friend says, you mean a rose? He says, that's it. He says, hey, Rose, what's the name of the memory course?
Oh, that's a good one, Armand.
But because, you know, memory's become a tremendously important factor. I know people now who have Alzheimer's. I'm watching an old friend of mine, a person who I've known for many, many years, with Alzheimer's. And I'm watching, I had a date with her on Friday to meet with her on Friday for coffee, and she forgot about it. And then I called, and she forgot who I was.
Isn't that sad?
I'm just watching it happen. Mm-hmm. So I want to understand it. I want to understand it better. And I'm learning things that are just, I'm amazed that they're not public, but nobody benefits by it. So I decide, Roberta, if you would with me, let's do as much research on this as we can.
Oh, sure. I would love to. I think it's very important.
I mean, what you said earlier about what we sort through, as in the course of a day, we take in billions of pieces of information. You don't know it. You can't imagine billions.
At any given moment.
You look around you at any time and you see things all over the walls that you could remember or not remember. Right. You could remember or not remember an advertisement. You could remember or not remember a sound or a smell or a taste or any of that. And you have to ask yourself, which do I choose to remember? So one is we want to understand what happens. We want to understand what we want to understand when you decide to commit to memory. Say, I better remember that. You know, what takes place. Now, this is not a human thing. Of course, animals, at some time, you know, you're a gazelle, and you're drinking water, and you hear the bush is rustling, and you're a gazelle who's never lived in Africa before. Somehow you got transplanted, and you never saw a lion, and now comes a lion, and he goes, eats your brother. And you go, ooh, whenever I hear that brush, I'm going to run. Because memory is one of the first survival tools.
That's right. And all organisms that live have to have some form of memory, smaller or larger, but they need memory in order to live, because in order to live in the moment, you have to have some point of reference from the past that helps you navigate where you're at in the present. And when you were describing the process, Armand, you made me think of what it takes to learn how to drive a car. Remember the first time you sat behind the wheel? How much attention you had to pay to all the commands and the levers and the buttons and the lights and this and that and the other. And you were so focused and you had to struggle to remember everything. Now, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, whatever it is, you get in the car and as you drive, you can listen to the music, talk on the phone, supposedly you're not supposed to, think about your bank account, do a zillion other activities, which means that the memory of how to drive the car has been committed to long-term storage, and it has become automatic. You can do it, you can remind yourself how it's done without having to think about it.
If those of you who grew up in New York in the 40s and 50s and maybe even early 60s, there was a thing called a Spalding ball. I showed you that ball.
Yes,
it was a little ball I grew up with. And the Spalding was magic because that's what we used to play in the streets with. And it was a ball that you could get. It was 10 cents or 12 cents. And it was an amazing thing. You could make up 100 games with it. And it was great. The other day I found one of these and I was playing with a friend of mine and I threw it. And I noticed that when I threw it, when I caught it without looking at the ball. I had committed to memory so much about this ball that I no longer had to look when the ball was coming. I caught it automatically, and there were things that came right out of my memory.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine, Roberta, as you're saying, if things can go so deeply into memory, and if every animal has a memory, and every amoeba has a memory, and then every cell has a DNA...
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let's get smaller.
Sure.
So imagine a cell is the size of a tiny one, like 1,000 on the head of a pin. And then we get one of those and we get its DNA. You know how tiny that is? Do you know somewhere in that DNA there's memory?
Mm-hmm. Oh, and lots of it.
Where?
It's...
Where? In which pocket? Where is this? You know, in the coat? In the shirt pocket? Hey, I left my memory in my shirt pocket on my DNA. Could you... Where is it?
Yeah.
And that's the amazing thing. That's why it's so fascinating.
Billions and billions of bits of memory are in...
And encoded survival, how you find water, why you need water,
yeah,
how you keep your body going.
And then you hand it over to the next generation so that memory is not just individual, there's a collective memory.
And then you change it a little.
Sure, every generation...
You change it. You change it a little, and then
something.
You bring something further to it, you know?
Sure.
And you know, this is remarkable.
What I described before about learning how to drive a car is one form of memory, which is it's actuated through repetition. you do something over and over and over and over again until it becomes imprinted in your neurological system so that it becomes an automatic function, activity. But there are other ways of
Let's stick with that one for a moment, okay?
Let's stick with that.
There's more than just two, because, of course, when we talk about DNA, we have memory we don't even know we have. So there's memory that's intrinsic. There's memory that's inherited. There's memory on how your heart should beat. You know, there's memory on how your body functions.
There's memory on how to deal with this, with the light of the sun, mm-hmm. so that you don't get burned. I mean, all sorts of things.
So you have some inherited memory, that's one. We'll call those the unconscious memories. And then conscious memories, if you want to remember something, what do you do? Now, this is what we're going to focus on. We're going to focus on some of what we've learned that's different than you might know about memory. And let me start this off with asking you a question, my friends. By the way, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. The name of the program is The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. And we're talking about memories,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we're talking about things that you may want to remember, things you may want to forget, things that you could remember. Why do we forget certain things? Why do we have no positive memories about something? Why can you? I mean, let me ask you all a question, and here's the question of the day. Would you please try to remember the 10, something that happened before the age of 10 that was one of your best memories ever? And now, it doesn't have to be the very best, but think about a wonderful memory that took place before the age of 10. Now, Roberta and I chose this before the age of 10 so that it's kind of free of the pubescent excitement and struggle
right,
that would be there.
Right, because the hormones really have an impact on what we
on
memorize.
Their own. So let's say before age 10. So think about it, my friends. If you're listening to the program, which you have to be in order to hear me saying think about it. So what do you remember? Before age 10, what's your best memory? I'm going to give you a minute to think about it because I don't want you to just scoot past it and say, you know, it was when I was in the park. Think about the memory.
Be specific.
Can you picture it? Yeah, be specific. Can
where
you picture where
you,
it was?
Who were you with? As
what,
many details as you,
what
as
happened?
You can. What happened? What were you wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Where? Was it sunny? Was it evening? Was it at the beach? Was it in the mountains? Was it in the city, in the car, in your house? Where, with whom? As many details as you can.
Do you have a smell connected to it?
Mm.
You might have a smell. You
or
might
a
have
song.
A smell. You know?
Sound.
A sound.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's take that memory, and here's what I'm going to ask you to do. If you would, I would like you to send me at Armand at thepositivemind.com, your best memory before the age of 10. You could send me two. That's what I'd like to know.
I'd like a copy of that email.
Yeah, of course. We'll go right
Roberta
to
Roberta for Health. So you can send a copy to me as well. I'd like to
we'll
to
collect
these
them.
Memories. Okay.
Of course you're going to see them, Roberta. So then I want you to imagine what is the worst memory that you had before the age of 10? Think about a horrible memory. Some people, it's really easy to remember. Before the age of 10, do you have a memory that is so strong, that is so severe? You know, so what I'd like you to do is to take those, and I'm going to show you something about those memories. We are going to show you something about those memories. So please, just send them to armand@thepositivemind.com. Send them, I'll collect them, I'll forward them to Roberta. She and I will discuss them with you. armand@thepositivemind.com. And so that make that a little project because you could become part of the series of programs that we're going to do that'll be coming up because we're going to use these memories. And it doesn't, you know, if we don't want me to talk about it, I won't, but I'd like to hear about it. Here's what they've kind of found out. They found out a few things about memory, but the most important one is that there is this repetition system, which is if you use repetition, well, in fact, let me
Well, that is what happens in school. As a student, you're supposed to memorize bits of information that the teacher considers relevant by reading the assignment many times over and over
Practice.
Again, and by repeating it to yourself or to a friend or in some form or another, so that by repeating it, you continuously activate the neurological activity that commits that memory to your nervous system.
And it's not just a static nervous system. According to the theory of neuroplasticity, which is some of the stuff that I've been studying, you could either use it or lose it. You could use it or grow it. You can, if you decide that you're going to learn violin and you practice violin and you do it over and over again and you repeat and you take that class and you want to go out and play baseball but you study the violin and you do it and you do it and you do it, you actually grow brain cells that other people don't grow. The guy who's doing the baseball is not growing baseball cells that are the equivalent of your violin cells. You're growing violin cells and it makes you unique. In the violin cells that you grow, you learn everything about timing and the complex sequential relationship between sounds that happen to be flowing back and forth and creativity. And all of this kind of works because of repetition. Repetition, the power of repetition, is very strong. There are people who only remember through repetition. There are people who only use that as their only skill. We've learned a lot about repetition over time. We've learned that repeating something and learning something is a good thing, but if you do too much of a similar kind of thing, sometimes it inhibits the one thing you're learning. It's called retroactive inhibition. If you're studying music, it's not good to study language following that because it's too similar. If you're studying music, it's good to study math following that because it's dissimilar. This way you solidify the music and then you solidify the math. So we've learned a great deal about it, but there's so much more recently that we've learned that it's going to knock you out. But we're going to talk about the main factor, and I want you to now go back to the three things you thought about, the two best memories and the one worst memory. What makes them such strong memories is the other way that we learn. I mean, so what is it that makes a lion, makes a gazelle remember that a rustling bush or the sound of a bush moving makes the, makes him run away? It's not just the lion appearing because it's a lion appearing. It's what emotion the gazelle felt following the lion's appearance. And what are those emotions?
Fear, terror. The more intense an emotion is, the more likely it is that the event that triggered that emotion is going to be remembered. In fact, one of the functions of emotions from an evolutionary standpoint could very well be memory, meaning that emotions help us remember the things that are important for our survival, and that if an event is associated with an emotion, it's not likely that we're going to forget it as easily as if it were not associated with an
emotion.
You're
saying a big thing there, Roberta, you know, and I mean, I'm feeling very excited about it, too, because you're saying that the function of memory, of emotion, is memory. Not the function of memory is emotion, but the function of emotion is memory. That if you can make an emotional commitment or connection to a thought, you will remember it better. So that's clear. You feel terror. You have all these hormones rushing through your body when you feel terror.
Not just to a thought, but to a behavior.
Sure. So there it is. I mean, the lion comes out, and now the lion eats your brother, right? And you have all that stuff going on, you know, as well. You have all these emotions going on. The next time that bush moves, you're sure as all hell going to run.
Right.
Because you're going to remember. So the deeper the emotion, the more the memory, to a certain point. We've also learned that there's a point at which, when there is too much emotionality, a person can dissociate, disconnect, and have no memory at all. We'll talk about that at a future time.
And that's another thing that protects survival by making something that could threaten to overwhelm the system, just shutting it off for a time, so that the system can settle down and then reactivate it.
And that's what you need to do sometimes.
It's all done in the service of survival.
Sometimes you develop that as a tool. Do you remember where you were when Kennedy was shot?
Me?
Yeah.
I do.
Almost everybody does, if they're over 20 years old.
And if you think of it, I was in Italy, and I didn't speak English.
But did you have an emotional reaction?
Not nearly as much as I think people here in the U.S., but I think what I reacted to were the emotions of the people around me, because I sensed that this was a big deal. I was too young to understand.
So the people around you were having deep emotional reactions,
yes.
And therefore you were having a deep... I remember the day the war ended, the Second World War. Not because the Second World War had meaning, but because everybody had this big emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
So it had this tremendous impact on me.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I think that also is possible, that if we're too young or if we don't understand what is going on, but everyone else around us is excited emotionally, that's contagious enough that we could be affected by that emotionality indirectly and commit that event to our memory system, simply because the intensity of the emotion existed, even though it was not our own emotions that were activated.
So with this as a basis, Roberta, do you know what we're saying?
Yeah.
We're saying that if emotion has as its purpose a way of helping you survive by increasing your memory, that the more emotional a person is, the more they may commit to memory, except if a person is so emotional that they are overwhelmed by the emotion and they can't think at all, which some people have. But the people who have a deep connection to their emotions are more likely to have a deeper connection to the memories. Therefore, women have better memories than men.
That kind of memory, yes.
They remember more things.
Yes. In fact,
not just that kind, not just emotional memory, but they remember more things.
In the studies that were done to research memory, women consistently score better than men in remembering when there is an emotion associated with the bit of information that is supposed to be memorized. And so what we're saying is that from the research that is being done on memory, it seems that if you can attach an emotion to an event, you are going to facilitate your retrieval of the memory of that event later on.
Therefore, get this. This is kind of an interesting thing. Did you ever practice at something and you work at an exercise? Like I was, I used to teach chess when I was a kid, and I would always be surprised that the people who were learning how to play chess would be so frustrated with themselves and have such big emotional reactions when they forgot something. Or if somebody's learning a language and they make a mistake on the language and they get such big emotional reactions and you get so angry at yourself. And recently I've been working with a Posit Mind program myself, which is a training program. And I'm doing the program and every now and then I make a mistake and I yell at myself. I get upset. Well, what am I getting upset about? I'm a fairly stable guy. Why am I getting upset? Well, according to this theory, by getting upset, you actually learn better. Therefore, all that frustration you ever felt, all those feelings you ever had when you were going to school, all the times you threw the book against the wall when you couldn't remember a formula, every time you kicked out something, every time you got frustrated, it wasn't just because you were a stupid person trying to learn. You were using an age-old technique on how to commit something to memory. You were adding emotion to the fact itself. And by adding an emotion to the fact itself, you drove that memory deeper into your psyche, into a place where you could retrieve it later. Aren't we smart? I'm so surprised at humans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, all of that. You think about, you try to remember, you're learning a language, you know, and you're trying to remember how to say bacows.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kidding.
One of your favorites?
One of my favorite words. How to say something in Italian. And you try to remember it, and you can't remember, and you just get angry at yourself for not remembering. So why are you getting angry at yourself? You just don't remember, but the emotion.
Well, you'll secrete adrenaline if you get angry, and then the adrenaline is going to interact with your amygdala and hippocampus, and this whole thing is going to go deeper and deeper into your brain, all the way almost to the center of it.
And it may help you retrieve.
And exactly, and then you won't forget it anymore.
Well, you know, it does more. I think sometimes by getting angry, you retrieve better. You know, in other words, you know, I'm so frustrated, I don't know where to go, I don't know which to turn, I don't know what to do.
It's both the commitment of the memory and the retrieval of the memory that is enhanced
through the very
emotion. Yes.
So don't knock your emotions when you're trying to learn. Roberto and I were trying to figure out, how do the English do it? You know, because they suppress emotion so much.
Actually, there's a study done, I believe, by the American Psychological Association related to the fact that some people tend to suppress emotions just out of habit, just out of a cultural thing, whereby they think that being too emotional is not a good, manners, not a good thing to do. So they suppress emotions. And it turns out that these folks find it harder to commit things to memory than people who allow their emotions to express themselves more freely. So this is actually true, Armand, what you just said about the style, you know, the non-emotional style. There is a person who is going to have to use more willpower to memorize because they don't utilize emotionality as much as other people do.
If willpower be repetition,
that's
through
what I
repetition
mean.
Because you don't have access to the other tools, you don't have your body. You know, one would imagine that the best way to remember something is to get just have a deep emotional reaction on purpose. We've got to try it. I'm going to try it out this week. I'm going to try to memorize something like the name of all the presidents, you know?
The name of all the presidents.
You know, and try to see if I could do it by doing it emotionally.
What kind of emotion are you going to
associate with? Oh, I'll include everything. I'll probably, you know, the one that I, frustration, even though it's not an emotion, is the one that I most likely associate with deep memory.
Well, maybe that works well for you.
That's right.
If you have learned to use your frustration as a way to memorize things, it may be a strategy that works well for you. And I think it does make sense, Armand, because when you're frustrated, you do secrete higher amounts of certain neurotransmitters. And basically, it's really about activation of nervous cells of neurons. If you activate them, they're going to get to work and they're going to pick up that memory bit, that information bit, and they're going to store it. But if you don't wake them up with some neurotransmitters, you know, they might just not react as readily.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We are with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I've got something interesting for you that you've never heard. If you listen to Paul McCartney talk about the creation of a piece of music, and I have just a few minutes for you to listen to Paul McCartney talk about how he uses his memory and emotion in an act of creation, I think you might find it interesting. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. I know we will. Michael. Liberty.
On WBAI 99.5 FM, the Caldwell Chronicle is on the air. I'm Earl Caldwell. Tune in for our broadcast every Friday, 3 to 5 p.m., right here on listener-supported Pacifica Radio in New York City.
I was on my way into a meeting in London, and I always like to drop off before I actually get into the meeting. So I like to just have a bit of a walk and experience life for a minute. Anyway, there's a guitar shop that I always drop in on the way down this street. And I went in and was chatting to the guy in there. He mentioned that he had a left-handed mandolin he wanted to show me. So I ended up getting it anyway. And I found the great thing about it was that I didn't know how to play it, because it's tuned like a violin, so I had no idea what the chords were. So this was good, because it took me back to when I was like a teenager, being presented with an instrument you didn't know how to play. So I had to figure it out for myself. So I found one chord, and I found another one, and I found a real strange chord, very simple shape, but it was an odd chord. I still don't know what the chord is, but it sounded great. So with this was over Christmas 2006, with this little instrument at home over the holiday, I started doing this little and stomping in the kitchen, you know, just enjoying myself, trying to find chords. And then I started, everybody's going to dance tonight, yeah, and just got that little thing going. And every time I did, my little three-year-old girl came running in, started dancing. So I fell in love with this song and the whole idea of the mandolin, the whole kind of hoedown aspect. And eventually it kind of wrote itself, just stuck a few more words in it. I thought, I'm just going to keep it simple. Everybody's going to dance around, everybody's going to stamp the feet, everybody's going to feel the beat, you know, not try and get too deep. And I say I liked it so much that I just thought, I've got to record this. So I ran in quickly and did it. And then we stuck it on the album as it seemed like a good atmospheric opening. Sometimes, you know, I just sit down and I'm trying to kind of write a pop song. You know, I've done it throughout my life. And it's an interesting thing to try and do. Something that is kind of catchy and might be attractive, I don't know, on the radio or whatever. So, yeah, I was just going over personal feelings about not having too much on my plate. Starts up, I've got too much on my plate. And then that's the way I write. I just follow that thought and think, what did I mean by that? Got too much on my plate? Explain yourself. So I just follow up, oh, what I meant was. And so, and then it eventually just panned out that after I got the verse, it just became this idea of my past, my ever-present past. But no deep meaning in it. I think what happens with me is I sometimes will just write a thing and people read more into it. And I kind of like that, because I think often you do things in a subliminal way. You don't actually realize what you're doing, you know, half the time. So something that I might think is quite a simple statement, somebody might go, yeah, but it means that. You go, oh, wow, yeah.
So this is Armand DeMille with you with the Prophet of Mind, Roberta Maria Atti. That's Paul McCartney talking about his creative process. But you can see, you know, Roberta, if you talk about a creative process, especially in creating music, you talk about memory, of course, because if you're going to lay down a line, you have to repeat the line, and then you repeat the line, and you extend it, and you expand it, but you're committing it to memory each time. And what you hear about Paul McCartney talking about, even though he is British, he talks about the emotional content that he brings to it. He brings the emotion to it. When I think about acting, and I think about people who are getting trained in method acting, they bring the emotion to it. You have to bring your emotion to it. sometimes, unless you're somebody who's had the emotion driven out of them. Many people have. So many people have been told that they have no right to be emotional on any level, and it's very hard for them. They're stuck with the other tool,
mm-hmm.
and the other tool is to memorize.
Right. Well, I wonder, though, Armand, whether, you know, there is, whether the emotions have a way of doing what they're supposed to do even when they're not expressed. And what I mean by that is that, you know, maybe even though a child may be told not to cry or not to scream or not to behave in an emotional manner, whether the emotion somehow finds its way into the child's nervous system and in some other, in a way that may not be expressive, but there's a way in which the neurotransmitters are still secreted, the amygdala is still activated, etc., etc. Now, that may have repercussions in the child's behavior that may be positive or negative later on. But I think in terms of memorizing that bit of information that is important to survival, I think that that is so important. Apparently in nature, that is such an essential function that it just happens, you know, regardless of what the culture says, whether it's right or wrong to, you know, be expressive. So I think there's a way, thank goodness, that bypasses the cultural limitations.
Well, you know, yes and no. Yes and no. It's not all bad. I mean, if somebody tells you, I remember people who talked about during the Second World War when their children were being, you know, when they were people outside with guns and your child is laying there and the child is frightened and you say to your child, do not cry. Because if the child cries, you're going to get killed. And in nature, the same thing happens all the time, where you suppress the whimper of a frightened being because you know they're going to get eaten if they're spotted. It's not all bad. It's somehow not all converted into a negative, the fact that you tell people to inhibit their emotion. If somebody gets really excited, we don't tell them, you know, just... We tell them sometimes don't get too excited.
I think we're saying the same thing.
That's right. That's right. And that, a person who has, Roberta, you know, a person who inhibits a deep emotional experience, you're right. If you don't cry on the outside, you can easily cry on the inside. The problem is when you don't cry on the inside. The problem is when you're not allowing yourself to have any emotions at all, then you're stuck to one survival tool. Now, just think about it. Them who don't cry, think. You know? I mean, that's the way it works. If you can't cry, you think. So think about the two survival mechanisms, which are the only two ways we have of committing something to memory. Besides that which we inherit is you either think, which is thinking through repetition, or you commit an emotion to it in some way. You attach an emotion to it. So if those are the two ways that we have, then people who don't think are going to be completely emotional, and people who are not emotional are going to be completely thinking because that's your only survival tool left. So what we're saying is that when a person becomes too emotional at a point, they can no longer think. When a person becomes too thoughtful at a point, they can no longer feel, and you need both for survival.
Right. Well, ideally, yes. Ideally, a combination of the two is the best recipe for survival. But I think what I was trying to say earlier on was that, you know, the emotions that are activated, let's say, in a normal nervous system are going to perform that function of memorization, facilitate the function of memorization, whether the person is allowed to express the emotion itself physically or not. However, I also believe, Armand, that what you just said there is very important, because when you suppress an emotion and you block the movement of that energy through the body, you may actually end up with a lingering memory that you can't get rid of. And what I mean by that is, let's say that you're in the process of grieving, but you're not allowed to cry and express it verbally and make noises and hit your fists against the wall or something. Let's say you're not allowed to express it at all emotionally, I mean physically. Well, what if then you kind of get halfway to that point and then you get stuck there? And then you can't get out of that anymore. Isn't that where people could actually get stuck in an emotion that keeps reactivating itself because the sequence is never brought to an end and that memory becomes almost an intrusive thought?
Locked. You can't get rid of it.
That you can't get rid of.
Right, it doesn't pass.
Right.
You know, the control of learning and remembering is crucially important for your brain. If the brain weren't highly selective about what was important to remember and learn, it would be chaotic. Just think of what would happen if your brain maps, if they recorded everything you heard, everything you felt, everything you thought, everything you smelled. Your brain would blow up. It couldn't take it. If everything you heard, saw, and felt was accurately and equally recorded, your brain map would be a hopeless, unintelligible mess, and your personal encyclopedia would be a jumbled, unusable reference source.
You know what, Armand? As you're saying that, I'm thinking of a water pipe where all the water goes down the pipe and it goes into a common reservoir. Isn't that what happens to memories that are not, let's say, they're not going to be committed to the mind that is able to retrieve them? Let's say things that are forgotten. Actually, I think there is a place where they all go that is a common reservoir of memories that then belongs to all of the human race. Isn't that, in the end, what the unconscious is?
Like, well, I don't know. It's one of the...
Like container of all the memory bits that are not remembered on the conscious level, to some extent?
There's a lot of theory about that. You know, there's a lot of theory about it. A lot says if you don't record it, you don't record it. A lot of it says when you get rid of it, when the esterase comes along and wipes out the neural connection to that thing, it's gone. Some theory says it becomes the gray outer layer of your cortex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an interesting thing, that the very thin outer layer is just all about memories that are kind of unused.
Right.
And another theory is that dreams brings all of this chaos into the foreground in a chaotic form, and you try to organize it. Well, you know, none of this is, I mean, all of this is, of course, speculation and theory, and if I was selling something, like if I was selling God, I would make a case for one thing, and if I was selling vitamins, I'd make a case for another thing. The interesting thing that we have is that there is so much research being done on the human brain right now that you could find ways of improving your brain, increasing your brain power, no matter what your age. You can forestall, put off any hope of having that kind of degeneration of your mind, and you could start fighting it now. You can start by learning about it. The brain learns... Let me just finish this, if you would. Your brain learns to control your attention. It just learns. And now here's part of the problem. The problem is paying attention, sticking with one thing. We're beginning to learn a little bit about the bifurcation of the human body in so many different ways, which is this kind of splitting that takes place. Being able to concentrate and stay on one subject seems to be the key to truly learning. Now, how do you stay on one subject? How do you stay on a subject if you're going to commit an emotion to it? How do you do it? How do you stay on something when you're trying to remember it and something is passing by? If you're working on a program to remember something and you're fixing dinner at the same time, how do you do it? How do you commit your brain to pay attention? When you don't pay attention, your memory and your learning are poor. What they call an attention deficit disorder, which a lot of people have, what the symptoms of it are, not that I'm agreeing that the thing exists, is the inability to pay attention, to give attention. And the problem with the inability to give attention is to stay in a single focus, is you can't remember. You cannot give it memory. The sharper your attention, the faster you learn, and the better you remember, and you all know that. If you stay at home and you study your schoolwork and you don't listen to the music, in fact, one of the things they said about listening to music is one of the worst ways in the world to learn is with any kind of music playing. It's like it's against learning. It works against it.
Armand, I have a lot of questions.
I know.
As I listen to you, I have all sorts of questions. I could become the so-called devil's advocate in a
sure.
second, because I'm thinking of what about if you relax your mind and take in everything that is going on without focusing on one particular item. Well, in a way, you're just absorbing information in sort of an indiscriminate way. Well, but if something is relevant in your environment, wouldn't the brain be able to select that bit of information automatically and relate to it differently than from the rest of it? Because it's an innate function of the nervous system to do so. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, perhaps.
I guess what I'm saying is, what about all the... Remember in the 70s, the 80s...
Well, wait, can we stick with... Here I am paying attention.
I'd like you, if you would, to pay
attention with this, just this one thing, because it's easy, because, you know, me too, Roberto, with you. When I meet someone who's got the kind of mind that you do, and when I'm sure you feel that way with me, we have the kind of minds that will wander into areas that will go to unexplored territories and bring about things like we did with the refugee syndrome that have not been discovered before and not been found. Thank God for that. When we hone in on a subject and we try to bring a subject to people, there's so much information we have that it gets very confusing. So what I try to do with you is to try to simplify it as much as possible. And in this case, before I go off on one of the tangents, which I would love to join you on, and we would advocate each other as demons, you know what I mean? I want to get to this, just this one thing. It's kind of trying to define what's important and what you want to remember. And we have this in the last few minutes, because when we come back, the next program we're going to do is exact specific tools that you could use to improve your memory and keep your brain growing. And we're not going to bring you the ordinary things we're going to bring you, which is, you know, like juggle slinkies. We're going to bring you something else. Got a good image?
Very good.
Juggle slinkies.
Mm-hmm.
The brain associates things that you hear, feel, think, or do with either a good or a bad outcome. So it wants to remember what is good and what is bad, because it's going to influence you in one way or another. So the brain wants to remember both extremes, the good and the bad. The brain is built that way. It's not so built to remember the mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
It's built for survival to remember the good and the bad. You can think of paying attention, getting an answer right, getting better at a task, having a happy outcome, having a sad outcome, and so on, as controlling powerful on-off switches in the brain. Because this is what leads to brain plasticity, the ability of the brain to grow new cells, which is what the dynamic memory is all about. This is what this amazing brain we have is.
And it's what a person is not able to do when they're locked in a memory that they can't get out of. You know, what we were saying before, when the emotion is not allowed to do what it's supposed to do and it gets stuck in the middle, people sometimes, like in post-traumatic stress disorder, keep remembering something that they don't want to remember, but that memory keeps coming up.
Well, there seems to be a point to that. You know, I'm going to talk about acetylcholine, dopamine, and norepinephrine just for a quick second, which are the three primary neurotransmitters, neuromodulators, I should say, that acetylcholine, which is secreted when you have any kind of a neural activity. But then what you have to remember is if you have a neural activity, you have an acetylcholine esterase, a thing that takes away that activity and dumps it for regeneration, to use it again. You have dopamine, which is released when you expect to be rewarded, you know, when something good happens, you know. You have norepinephrine, which is released whenever you encounter something new or surprising. It's the brain way of saying, hey, here's something new, look at this, norepinephrine. Interestingly, each of these neuromodulators shape memory and learning processes in different ways. So if there's any way that you're knocked out of any of them, now, for example, Roberta, you talked about post-traumatic stress disorder. I always think of that as a disorder in the acetylcholine, in the esterase. Now, when I say the esterase, I think of it as a disorder in the ability to clean up the junk. It happened. You go through it. You let it pass. This is like emotions. An emotion happens, you feel it, you go through it completely, you let it pass. Too many people have an emotion, they can't feel it. They don't let themselves feel it, they can't let it pass. It gets locked up, and I think that's because the esterase is not working, that it gets bogged up, that your brain gets filled with this stuff, and you just can't get rid of it. You want to be able to get the cleansing process going.
I think it has something to do
with... It's like having a clean colon, you know? It's
It has something to do also with a lot of emotional energy that isn't getting expressed and is not... It's not... It's being activated, but it has nowhere to go.
And there's no... Right, and you don't know how to let it go somewhere.
Like a broken record. And I think to a lesser degree, that happens to people who can't get out of sad memories, who can't get out of bad memories that they don't like remembering, but somehow they can't get out because they keep going back to that memory of guilt or shame or pain or whatever it is. So, yes, I think, Armand, in the end, it's all about the chemistry of it, because we are a chemical soup, cauldron of chemicals. But I think that, you know, someone like yourself, you are a specialist in helping people undo, or not undo, unlock that door that would open that channel so that that emotion can be expressed or felt or whatever it is that needs to happen and done with, so you can move on with the rest of your life, right?
It gets locked up inside of you, you know, and all a person needs to do is to find their tools that will allow the emotion to process. You need to let it process, not just shut it off.
I have a question, Armand.
Could
it be that that emotion is not getting completely released because some of the memory has been suppressed?
Sure. So you might not have the whole piece there. You know, like, for example, I know people who have their cat dies, you know, and they're grieving their cat, and they get stuck in the grieving of their cat. But what they forgot is that their mother gave them the cat, and their mother had died 2 years earlier.
Uh-huh.
So they don't go through the grieving of the cat because they'd have to touch on the emotions of the mother.
See?
So it's exactly what you're saying.
Right.
See, the whole idea is process, to try to get it. We want two things. We want to be able to pay attention, which means I want my mind not to distract me, not to take me away, not to run me off on 10 different subjects, you know, that I can't handle at once. So being able to pay attention has to do with clearly being able to handle your emotions, right? Or being able to handle your jumbled thinking. And these are survival mechanisms.
Mm.
And so what we want to do, we're going to focus with you, my friend, since we're out of time, I'm going to focus with you on on going to the aging brain and what happens to minds when they age. We'll do that next week, Roberta.
There's so much to say about memory, what it is, how we understand it. I can't wait. I look forward to talking about it in all these different ways.
Aging brain. And if you want a copy of today's program, you can go to thepositivemind.com and you could listen to it. And Roberta, you can go to Roberta's website.
You can go to creativehealthsolutions.org.
And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.
Your sweet expression, smile you gave me, the way you looked when we met. It's easy to remember, but so hard to forget. I hear you whisper, so hard to forget. So I was free to have your hand caress me, fingers press me tight. I'd rather dream than have that lonely is clear before me, and now it brings me regret. It's easy to remember, and so hard to forget. It's easy.